que j'aurai le plaisir de mener en anglais qui bénéficiera de la traduction, non pas simultanée, mais de l'interprétation de Leslie Witt Jacobsen, qui est ici et qui vous fera des résumés pertinents des différentes séquences que nous aurons avec nos auteurs, mais pour qu'on puisse mener cette discussion avec nos auteurs. Et comme, bon, alors peut-être que vous avez révisé, mais disons, mon danois, mon norvégien et mon suédois sont ce qu'ils sont, eh bien, on va faire ça en anglais. I will start by presenting the authors, the four authors that we have with us on this panel tonight. Starting, of course, with Anna Gruer. Did I pronounce it right?
Yes.
Oh,
almost.
Good. Almost. Thanks. Gruer. Okay.
I was already fans.
Okay. Right. From Denmark. Also from Denmark, Leif Davidson.
Is that? It's okay.
It's okay. Good. Now comes the hard part. From Norway, Ingar Jonsrud.
That's perfect.
Okay, good. And on your right there, we have Johan Theorin from Sweden.
Right.
Okay. So, of course, we will talk a lot about their novels, but let's start off with this concept. Of Nordic crime novel. Actually, it's interesting because there's a pun with French, because in French a thriller is called a polar, so it's the polar polar, which is interesting. I mean, how would you describe this Scandinavian, you know, crime novel? Does that really exist, or is it just a marketing concept? Who wants to start?
Je with... interprète la question ou pas?
Life knows it. Oui.
Donc, je vais commencer avec une question sur ce genre, le roman policier ou le polar, comme on dit en français. En fait, il y a un petit jeu de mots avec le polar, puisqu'on a avec des auteurs scandinaves, donc polar, le polar, polar. Donc, on va commencer avec des questions. Qu'est-ce que c'est que ce genre polar scandinave?
Là, if you want.
Okay, well, now it is. Well, it's not that easy to define, but I think there are some points you can make around this. First of all, I think the basic concept goes back to the 60s, where there was a Swedish couple called Sjöwall and Valö that transformed the sort of Agatha Christie mystery novel into a genre where you could use it to describe society and criticize society in a socialist way, Marxist way even. But really, in modern times, I think it's Stieg Larsson and the Millennium that sort of put it on the map and made it a worldwide concept. Because if you look at the three Scandinavian countries, the stuff that is being produced is very different. And one could say that there's, for me to, at least, there's two strands. There's this extremely dark and violent type of detective crime stories that especially some of the Swedes practice, where they might, you know, they live in such a Swedish normal welfare city, society, that they need these horrifying stories to not to have too boring an everyday life. But then you have another strand. This is also basically Swedish, which is what we call the femi, or feminine novels that came out 20 years ago, maybe. They started out where you have a female protagonist, woman as a detective, a journalist, or whatever, and it's very important that she solves a crime. But it is even more important that you know everything about her private life, how she changes the diapers, how she breastfeeds her kids, and how she has trouble with her husband. And altogether, it creates this special Nordic concept of detective or crime stories being society-orientated, and at the same time cozy and nice, so you can sleep after you have read it. Denmark, I think, is different. Oh. And I don't think we put that much... Okay.
Pardon? Merci.
We just summarize, you know, the Swedish case, and then we get to the Danish case.
Donc, ce n'est pas très difficile, c'est pas facile de faire un sommaire de ce genre mais, actuel. Mais en fait, on doit revenir sur les années 60 avec les pares Serval et Valeux qui ont commencé avec le roman policier et le roman noir qui parlent des problèmes dans la société. Et puis maintenant, on passe à Stieg Larsson qui a vraiment... créer un énorme intérêt dans le genre. Mais les livres qui sortent des trois pays sont très différents. Mais je sens deux choses qui sont communes avec les deux. Dans un premier temps, il y a une description d'une société sombre, violente, une société dure. Mais en même temps, il y a aussi un côté féminin. Par exemple, il y a 20 ans, avec le début de la présentation d'une femme, détective femme féminin, qui doit résoudre le problème. Mais on n'a pas seulement le crime, mais on commence à savoir beaucoup plus sur sa famille, sur sa vie personnelle. Et donc... dans le roman policier nordique, c'est plutôt le mélange de la société et puis de la vie privée des personnages.
Well, as I was saying, the Swedes and the Norwegians have been very strong on this, and you have Larsson, you have Munkle, you have Nesbø, and other. While I think in Denmark we have great crime writers, but where we have made our mark, I think, is in television series. Which we have produced some very great crime stories for the past 10 years. The Killing, maybe you've seen some of it in France or Switzerland also. I'll just end by saying that I shouldn't really be talking about the Nordic Polar because I don't write Nordic Polar. I write more thrillers based on the tradition I write on has nothing to do with Scandinavia. It's based on people like John le Carré or Graham Greene, if you want to have some names to chew on.
Oui, donc on a constaté que la Suède et la Norvège ont eu énormément de succès dans ce genre. Mais je pense que nous, les Danois, nous avons fait beaucoup plus eu un impact sur la télévision avec les séries télévisées comme The Killing and The Bridge que vous devez peut-être connaître. Mais moi, je suis là, mais je n'écris pas des polars scandinaves, en fait. Moi, mon genre, c'est plutôt de genre Jean le Carré, les romans d'espionnage. Mais bien sûr, je fais partie.
So Johan, the Swedes are... You know, are violent and very dark people in effect, and that's why they write so good, very dark novels.
No. We're like the Swiss. We're very peaceful. I think Leif made some very good points. But of course, when there is a crime in Sweden, it sort of becomes a trauma for us. 30 years ago, our prime minister was shot on the street walking home from the cinema. And I remember I was in the United States when it happened, and I heard it. And someone said, "You know that the Swedish prime minister has been killed?" And I said, "No, it must be the Swiss prime minister, because no one shoots people in Sweden or Switzerland, for that matter." So it was a big trauma, and it's an unsolved crime. And at that point, Swedish crime fiction was sort of in a low point. Very little was written, and it wasn't very read. But then, a few years afterwards, Henning Mankell came along, a few years after the Palme murder, and wrote about a Swedish policeman who sort of tries to take care of he's sort of a socialistic policeman who tries to restore order. Wallander is his name, of course. And he became very popular. And I think it was a way of dealing with this trauma in real Swedish history of the Palme murder. And we dealt with it by reading crime fiction.
Oui. Donc, nous, les Suédois, nous sommes très violents et très sombres, comme vous le savez. Mais non, on est en fait, on est très paisibles. Mais quand il y a un crime chez nous, en fait, ça nous choque. C'est un drame énorme. Et il y a quelques années, notre Premier ministre a été assassiné dans la rue en sortant du cinéma. En entendant ça, j'étais à l'étranger. Je pensais que ce n'est pas vrai, ce n'est pas possible. Ça doit être, en fait, le Premier ministre suisse. Ce n'est pas possible que ça puisse être le nôtre. Mais à ce moment-là, les polars suédois, ils n'étaient pas très... il n'avait pas énormément de succès, mais l'arrivée de Henning Mankell avec le personnage Wallander, le personnage qui est beaucoup plus avec les gens pour les aider et puis qui prend en compte des personnes, le côté humain, il est devenu très populaire. Donc on utilise maintenant le genre pour faire face à nos problèmes de violence dans notre pays, à mon avis.
Anna, from your point of view, do you share this view that this was sort of a starting point? What was the starting point for this emerging crimes, crime novels, seeing the dark?
Yeah, I can see your point, but I still think it started with Shuvalvalu. Who brought in the political story as well as the private life of the detective and made a brand new style for the crime novel. They were the first to do it.
And that's still the originality of this kind of genre.
Yeah. I do think so, but as life, I feel a bit misplaced because my crime novels are not very Scandinavian. Mm-hmm. They're very British, actually. I'm going back to Agatha Christie and back to Dorothy L. Sayers, in a current setting, but the crimes are more like them. They're not very sadistic. I don't have serial killers. I don't have a lot of politics and so on. So they're not very Scandinavian, actually. And I think that's one thing that's beautiful in Scandinavia now, that people write so different crime novels. You can have everything from Karin Alvtegen, who makes very, family-oriented small stories, to very hardcore political things like Life G.W. Pearson. And it's very different. And that's the beauty of it, I think.
Donc, oui, pour moi, le début, en fait, c'était, comme disait Life, Cheval au Valu, qui ont commencé ce genre. C'est le mélange du politique et la vie privée des personnages qui a créé une marque, un style unique. Mais en fait, mes romans à moi ne sont pas forcément, sont pas vraiment de style scandinave. C'est plutôt les styles d'Agatha Christie, par exemple. C'est pas très violent ni brutal. Mais c'est bien de quand en Scandinavie, on a énormément de styles différents.
Inga, there is something striking when one travels to Scandinavia, and it's the environment, and how much does this environment influence, or how deep is the importance of the environment in the essence of these novels, and especially in the crime novels, meaning the prolonged night, or the constant daylight, and the huge forests and the dramatic sceneries, and coming from Norway.
I think it, of course, it varies from author to author, but quite a lot of authors, I'm probably among them, you use the scenery, you use the cold winters, you use the dark nights or the summers to describe your characters or to build your characters and giving them some kind of a background, setting a scene. And I think, as Anna said, that I think you can ask 100 Scandinavian crime authors, and everyone will say, "Well, I'm not writing Scandinavian crime, but everybody else is," because it's, I think, coming from Scandinavia, you see that there are so many different varieties, yeah, and your opening question is it a marketing brand? Yes, it is, but it also has some truth to it. And I think that a lot of the smart thing has been said about it already, but I think there's one more perspective, which is that I think very often in Scandinavian crime, you can see that the bad guy, the murderer, he is a product of his society. He's not killing people because he wants to just get rich or just because he wants to get rid of his mother-in-law. There are something about society that makes him a criminal. So it's, as Leif said, it's about criticizing the society that we come from. Mm-hmm.
Donc l'environnement et ça joue énormément, bien sûr, les nuits longues, le soleil de minuit, etc. Mais ça varie énormément parmi les auteurs. Bien sûr, on utilise le froid et le fait que les journées sont sombres pour décrire nos personnages, pour mettre une certaine ambiance. Mais si on pose la question aux auteurs scandinaves, ils vont dire, oh, non, moi, je n'écris pas des polars scandinaves. Parce qu'il y a tellement de variétés. Et les variétés sont reflétées aussi dans l'environnement des trois pays. Mais dans le crime scandinave, le personnage principal est un produit de la société où il habite. Il ne va pas faire des meurtres, etc., parce qu'il veut. Mais en fait, c'est parce que la société l'a rendu.
Yes, go on with this question of society. There's also this sort of Protestant background that is quite important in those novels. The fact that you know there's a lot of social control. Would you agree with that? Or want to?
Well, I could say. Okay. No, it's not really Protestant anymore. This is the Scandinavian welfare systems, which are sort of cushioning people and making them very safe and also, in a sense, very frustrated because everything is sort of set out from birth to grave. And it's sort of a social democratic concept. And a writer like Mankell, he's a great example of this socialist, social democratic writing. You have the social democratic Sweden, and some chaos erupts. A murder is taking place. People are insecure. Then comes along this man with an ulcer and a bad marriage and trouble with his daughter, and he solves the murder, and social democratic peace is resurrected. And then another murder takes place, and you have a series of 10 books. So it's very well done by him. but that's a concept, you know. You cannot have disorder in Scandinavia. Disorder they hate. We hate. And Sweden is maybe the best example of it. And I think it's funny you say you are not a violent country. For us Danes, Sweden is an extremely violent country. They have a prime minister murdered. They have a foreign minister murdered. They have cars burning in Malmö almost every day. They have lots of crimes that we don't even think about in Denmark. So, but the Swedes are expert in saying, no, we are a peaceful country. Because we close our eyes and we leave it to the crime writers to describe this, but the papers, they won't touch it.
Yeah. Before you answer, of course you will.
Non, c'est pas forcément un cadre protestant qui influence. C'est plutôt le socialisme, le système de social en Scandinavie, où les gens sont très bien, ils sont très sécures, mais ils sont aussi frustrés. Et parce que tout est présenté pour eux, de la naissance jusqu'à la mort. Et Mankell, il fait un très bon exemple de ça dans son écriture, parce qu'il y a un meurtre au milieu de cette société qui est vraiment où il n'y a pas normalement dans de désordre, et c'est ce concept qui prend, il a énormément de succès avec ça.
Yes, and about donc les Suédois pour les Danois sont des gens très violents. Johan, would you agree with that? You're discovering today that you're coming from
yes. Leif is telling us. I feel like
violent and dangerous country.
I feel like the future Swedish tourism is at stake here, and Leif is trying to keep people away from Sweden.
No, but this social control thing is still. In your latest novel that was published in French, called Fin d'été.
Yeah.
There are lots of intertwining secrets coming from the past, and there's this sort of big unresolved things coming from the past, and you can feel the heaviness of the society.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's special because I'm writing about an island where. And on island, the social control is extra strong, I think, mm-hmm. compared to the mainland. But also, I mean, what should I say? What Leif said? I think, as I said, that there is a before and an after with this murder of Olof Palme that sort of changed Sweden. And after that, there has been more crime and more violent crime for the last 30 years with. The latest thing being the car fires, but it's sort of it's still seen as something. What do you say? Something an anomaly for most Swedes that this happened, and we're sort of shocked every time a minister gets killed. It shouldn't happen in Sweden because it's so peaceful, and we still have this sort of slight innocent in us that Sweden shouldn't be like that. And maybe that's a good thing to have this innocent and not become cynics and say, well, that's Sweden. It's a horrible country, because we don't think so.
It's a great country.
Yeah. J'ai peur que Leif va empêcher les touristes de venir en Suède avec ses commentaires. Mais c'est vrai que l'histoire de contrôle social est quelque chose dont j'écris dans mes livres. Il y a souvent des secrets du passé et des choses qui sont non résolues. Mais moi, j'écris des histoires sur une île, en fait. Et le contrôle social est encore plus puissant sur cette île. Et j'ai l'impression qu'avant, il y avait un avant le meurtre de Olof Palme et après. Et maintenant, avec les incendies dans les rues, dans les voitures, on est devenu plus conscient du crime en Suède. On trouve que c'est pas normal. On est toujours choqué par chaque fois qu'il y a un meurtre ou quelque chose d'abominable. On reste toujours innocent dans nos cœurs collectifs.
I think Anna wanted to add something.
Yes, I was thinking about the Protestantism that you mentioned, and I think it's a very important part of our books, actually. Because I have a friend in Italy, he lives in Rome and has done so for 40 years, and when he reads my books, his reaction is, you're so spoiled. You're used to everything is all right, and even the poor ones are actually quite rich, and there's no corruption, and you take that for granted when you write about the police, that nobody is on the take. And you know, he feels we are very spoiled, and that connects beautifully with Leif's statement. This is about welfare, the Scandinavian welfare system, where everybody is kind of cushioned.
And must be happy.
And must be happy, and actually we're not. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of very, very unhappy and very poor.
So
you use
those gaps to write your stories.
Yeah.
Because although
actually,
I mean, I understand what you say about bringing back the Agatha Christie's style and stuff.
Yeah.
But still, to me, as a non-Scandinavian reader, and I'm trying not to be affected by the marketing effect. It's really, it couldn't have been written by someone from another part of the world.
Yeah,
it's really,
exactly.
You,
And that's where we can't run from it. We are Scandinavian writers, mm-hmm. even though we feel mm-hmm.
And that's
feel
what
we
makes
not.
It so interesting.
Yeah.
Pour moi, c'est en fait, oui, il s'agit de l'idée de protestantisme. Parce qu'en fait, par exemple, j'ai un ami à Rome, et quand je parle avec lui, il dit, en fait, vous êtes tellement gâtés, vous avez tout dans votre société, il n'y a pas de corruption, il y a la sécurité sociale, tout le monde va bien, vous devez être heureux, non? Mais en fait, non, on n'est pas heureux. On devrait l'être, mais on est misérable entre nous aussi. Mais c'est vrai qu'on fait des histoires, nos histoires sont dans les trous entre cette idée de perfection, de société parfaite et la misère. Et c'est ça qui fait le genre scandinave.
I just want to say, yeah. I have a summer house on the west coast of Denmark, and there's a small town called Ringkøbing. There's a sign when you enter the town. It says, welcome to the happiest town in Europe.
Oh, yeah.
That's how we see ourselves. But if you look at the statistics, we have the highest suicide rate in Europe. And that's what we writers exploit, because the surplus...
I think Switzerland is second.
Oh, well, it's maybe we could say about Switzerland and Denmark, yeah, what Graham Greene wrote about Switzerland. I will not quoted here because then I'll offend you all.
En fait, j'ai une maison de vacances où il y a un panneau à l'entrée de la ville où c'est marqué bienvenue à la ville la plus heureuse en Europe. Mais en fait, chez nous en Scandinavie, on a un taux de suicide très important. Mais on exploite ça dans nos livres.
Inga, of course, when you think about this disruption of violence, as there was Olof Palme and the assassination in Sweden, but the Utøya murders were also a very shocking event in Norway. Has this changed something on the psyche of the population and maybe also on the literature scene?
Definitely, and that is kind of the the sad backdrop of this conversation. You know, we are now coming out of a summer where all of Europe has been traumatized by several brutal terrorist attacks, and for Norway to. I've been working as a journalist in Norway for 15 years, and when I started working in my newspaper, the Prime Minister's office is here, my newspaper is there, and I could walk through the entrance, throughout the building, from one side to the other side of the Prime Minister's building, without showing any ID, without showing any proof of who I was. And that was how secure Norwegians felt up until the 22nd of July 2011. And what happened was that there was a bomb that exploded by the Prime Minister's office, and then the guy who committed the murders, Breivik, drove his car out to this political youth camp where he assassinated, I think, 68 or
86.
Yeah, 80 in total, 86 in total. Yeah. There were very few were killed by the explosion because it was in the summer and most people were on vacation. But I think 77 kids were killed on that island. And you know, Norway is a small country. Everybody knew someone who either had family there, who was there themselves. My colleagues in my newspaper, good friends of mine, they were there 2 hours before. They weren't sure whether they would stay there to continue working or whether they should return to the mainland. They returned to the mainland, and that might have saved their lives. So, of course, this backdraft kind of I think you can write stories now. You can describe brutality, you can describe mentality in a totally different way than what you could 5 or 6 years ago. And what's also important with the terrorism in Oslo was that, you know, it wasn't an Islamic fundamentalist who was doing it. It was one of us. It was a guy that was, you know, he was Norwegian generations back. He was brought up. He was, he could, you know, be any one of us.
Oui. Donc, la violence en 2011, le 22 juillet, à Oslo, a changé la mentalité des Norvégiens complètement. Mais on a un contexte très triste. On sort d'un été avec des attaques de terrorisme abominables. Mais je me rappelle, il y a 15 ans, quand je travaillais au bureau de mon journal à Oslo, je pouvais aller à pied du bureau du Premier ministre, entre le bureau du Premier ministre jusqu'à mon bureau, sans être obligé de montrer quoi que ce soit comme identité. Et maintenant, on pense maintenant à la bombe et les attaques sur l'île où 77 jeunes ont été tués par Breivik, comme on connaît l'histoire. Et c'est vrai que ça a changé énormément la mentalité des populations norvégiennes.
In the few minutes that we have left, I'd like to concentrate a bit on your various books and. I'd like to start with you, Leif, because there's also something interesting. It's the relationship between the Scandinavian countries and Russia, which is quite interesting and sometimes difficult to understand from a central or southern European point of view. I mean, this proximity. And your novel, La mort accidentelle du patriarche, in French, is talking about this. It's a story. I won't tell the story now, of course, but it's a wonderful story about a couple, a young lady from Brezhnev era Russia, Soviet Union. And a Danish guy who's doing business, trying to do business. So, and it starts off the whole story. What about this relationship with Russia?
Well, we need the whole evening, so I'll do it. Cool. Well, first of all, I'm a writer that writes about what interests me and where I travel and where I go, and I've been to Russia so many times, so I keep finding stories. That's one part of it. The other part of it is that you're right, we are 2 hours flight from the Soviet Union and Russia and a member of NATO, and for the whole period of the Cold War, our main enemy was the Soviet Union. 5 years ago, no more, you know, 5 years ago we had a new defense survey done by the government saying that for the first time ever in the Danish history, and that's more than 1,000 years, we had no enemy in our vicinity. Now, with Mr. Putin, they're applying for Russian speakers because they fired them all, and they're applying for spies that know about missile systems and bombs and Russia, because Russia has moved back into the sphere of being maybe not an enemy, but at least somebody we have to watch. So we always have this dual relationship with our big neighbors. When I lived in Moscow or when I traveled around Russia, the Soviet Union, you always had to make three toasts. One for women, one for peace, and one for 500 years without war between Russia and Denmark. Because we always sided with Russia and we always lost. So therefore we have this, you know, relationship with this enormous country. The last Tsar, his mother was Danish, and he's now reburied in St. Petersburg. So there's this, I think, hate-love relationship with this enormous country where St. Petersburg has more inhabitants than Denmark. And every time I come over there, you know, Denmark's such a small country. Why don't you shut up and do what you tell you? And we say, no, we won't do that. So it's very interesting. Therefore, it's for me as a writer and as a journalist, it's wonderful material. It will never stop being wonderful, interesting, and fantastic, dramatic, and dangerous. So thank you, Russia.
Je remercie la Russie de m'inspirer à écrire des romans, des histoires qui sont passionnants, intéressants et qui sont sans fin, en fait. Mais c'est vrai qu'on est au Danemark, on est à 2 heures de la Russie, et donc on est depuis toujours de proches voisins. Mais il y a 5 ans, il y a un sondage au Danemark, et pour la première fois, il y a 5 ans, il disait qu'on n'avait pas d'ennemis proches à nous. Mais maintenant, ça a changé avec Poutine. C'est vrai qu'il cherche encore des espions, des décisions politiques autour de la Russie sont beaucoup plus chargées. Et c'est pour ça qu'on aura toujours une relation très importante avec ce pays.
Anna, would you describe the mechanics of your latest book, because it's quite it's thrilling because it's a thriller, but there's a very special thing about time. Can you say a few words? It's called in French, it's called Le Détective Chauve.
Yeah, because my detective is bald. And he is that in all the books. Le Détective Chauve is a very, very classical crime novel. It's about family, and it's about revenge, and it's about time. Because 2 kids from the same family have been killed on the day exactly when they turned 16 years and 27 days. First the brother, and a couple of years later, the sister. 16 years, 27 days. That's very Agatha Christie, no? Now this couple, this unhappy couple, who are the parents of these 2 dead children, they have 1 more son. And as he's getting closer to becoming 16 years and 27 days, they get very scared. And the police won't listen because they think they're stupid. They don't even believe the first two were murdered. They thought it was an accident. So they have to contact the bold detective, and he has to solve this crime. And it's, or no, he doesn't have to solve it. He has to prevent a crime. And it ends up on Roskilde Festival. I don't know if you know it.
Don't spoil the story.
Yeah. Where there's a big hunt for the killer. And it's actually, I think it's very thrilling at that point. And I feel a lot for that book because it's a lot about my own 3 children. And especially about the youngest one, who was my primary source for knowledge about Roskilde Festival and about being 16 at that moment in history.
Alors le thématique du temps figure énormément dans mes livres, et je parle un peu sur mon dernier livre, où il s'agit de 2 enfants qui sont tués après la même durée de temps, c'est-à-dire 16 ans et 27 jours. Donc une famille, ils ont perdu 2 enfants de cette manière après le même délai. Ils ont un 3e enfant, et ces parents-là, ils sont morts de trouille, ils vont perdre leur 3e enfant après le même nombre d'années et de jours. Et la police ne veut pas l'entendre, donc ils doivent s'adresser à ce fameux détective Chauve, qui est engagé pour empêcher le meurtre de ce jeune. Et ce livre m'est très cher parce que ça me rappelle mes 3 enfants, dont le dernier il vient de passer les 16 ans, et j'ai beaucoup appris sur le festival musical au Danemark qui s'appelle Roskilde Festival. Alors j'ai appris beaucoup par mes enfants.
Johan, your latest book, translated in French, called Fin d'été, was just released now, I think. There's also it's also a story about a boy and about time. There's actually many stories becoming one, or you know, and also revenge and mysteries. Can you tell us a little bit about? Can you tease us a bit into it?
It starts with two dramatic episodes, connected but very far apart in time. And the first one is 1930, where a farmer who is very hated is getting buried on Öland, this island. And it's a hot summer day, just like today. And while they are lowering the coffin with this man, people hear three knocks from inside the coffin. And they take him up and call for the doctor. And the doctor pronounces him dead, this man. And as the coffin is lowered once more, there are new knockings from inside the coffin. So that's the first one. And 65 years later, I'm going, well, there. Well, 65 years later, there is another strange event, because on a summer night, a ship comes into the bay on Öland, and a young boy rows out, just like I used to do when I was small on the island, in his rubber boat. And I always tried to go as far as I could before looking down and see how deep it was and turning back. And this boy does the same, but when he starts turning back, this ship comes upon him and sinks his little boat, and he has to climb aboard. And as he walks around, he doesn't see anyone, but soon he finds a man who's lying dead. A sailor is lying dead on the ship. And he finds more and more sailors dead or dying on this ship. And he finally leaves and comes ashore and meets the sort of detective of my story, who is also an old man, who was present at this strange funeral with the knockings. So, and what these two things have in common is what the rest of the book is about, I should say. Well, thank you very much.
Alors, dans mon livre, il s'agit de deux épisodes, deux histoires qui sont entremêlées. La première, dans les années 30, 1930, il y a un fermier, un homme agricole qui est en train d'être enterré. Il fait chaud, et quand le cercueil est mis dans la terre, on entend trois frappes. Et le médecin est appelé, et le monsieur, il prononce le monsieur mort. Et donc, ils remettent le cercueil dans la terre. Et encore des frappes. Alors voilà, c'est la première partie. Et puis on passe 65 ans plus tard. Et il s'agit d'une autre histoire avec un grand bateau qui vient vers l'île, Öland, dont j'écris. Et un petit garçon prend son petit bateau vers la grande. Et comme je faisais quand j'étais enfant, il allait le plus près possible vers ce bateau. Mais il est... En fait, son bateau est retourné. Donc, il est obligé d'aller sur le bateau, le grand bateau. Mais il découvre, sur celui-là, des marins qui meurent. Mais il est obligé de retourner avec cette nouvelle. Et là, il rencontre le détective qui était présent il y a 65 ans au premier intrigue avec le fameux cercueil avec les frappes.
Ingar, you are spoiled because you can talk about two novels. There's one called Those Who Follow and another one Calypso. Can you tell us in a few sentences what it's about and what the plot is and the inspiration?
Those Who Follow, Les Adeptes in French, is the one that has been released here, and it's. I was a correspondent in Sweden for 10-12 years back, and then there was this huge murder case that every Swede, every Scandinavian probably remembers, which is called the Knutby case. And Knutby was, in short, it was a pastor in a Christian community, a Christian sect, and he convinced, brainwashed his own nanny, his own babysitter, to kill his wife. And there, and after that, she went over to the neighboring house and she shot the guy who lived there in the face because he was married to the pastor's mistress. This is a true story. And how he did it was actually one of the ways he convinced this this babysitter to do it was that he sent her text messages from an anonymous phone. And he claimed that they were sent by God. This is also true, actually. So, and I was covering, and you know, working as a journalist, when we started working with this, you could see that there was religious fundamentalism. Everybody was having sex with everybody. It's like a journalist's wet dream come true. And I followed this case for almost a year through two trials, and I met these people in this small community. And you know that they weren't stupid people. They were young. They were smart. They were good looking. They had all things going for them. But even so, they were living in this parallel universe. So I thought to myself then, this was 12 years ago or something, that, you know, this is material for a book. So that is where the Les Adeptes starts out, is that there's a police, my hero, a policeman called Inspector Bayer, starts investigating some mysteries going on in the Christian sect. And soon some people in the sect gets murdered, and they discover that this sect has been doing things that isn't normally connected to religious activity. And the story takes us back then to the years before the Second World War. It's about racial hygiene, it's about Nazism, and the shadows from the war still darkening our days or the present. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Donc je pense à il y a 12 ans quand j'étais journaliste, je couvrais une histoire qui était vraiment exceptionnelle, un religieux qui avait convaincu la personne qui gardait ses enfants de tuer sa femme. Et il a envoyé des textos à la gardienne pour en disant que c'était des messages de Dieu. Donc c'était un cas vraiment, c'était vrai, et j'ai connu les gens, et ils étaient des personnes tout à fait qui avaient l'air normales, mais ils vivaient dans un univers parallèle. Et ça, j'ai pensé, ça, c'est du bon matériel pour un livre pour moi. Alors, c'est mon inspiration.
OK. Leif, your story is also playing with time, because there are lots of flashbacks. And there's one, this is the way I felt about this book. Extraordinary description of the 70s in Soviet Union, and this impossible love story that will then unfold to the present, to because there's it's a thriller, it's almost a political thriller in nowadays Russia, with a president called Popov, but we know who it is, actually. But can you tell us about, you know, what interested you so much in this Brezhnev era time? You know, and the contrast also between today and 40 years ago.
Well, that's true. Popov is of course Putin, but I call him Popov because Popov is the name of a very great Russian clown. Well, it's not really about book. I think it's not a novel about Brezhnev's Russia. It's a novel about two twins, two boys, and their mother is a Russian. She marries a Dane, and then she's kicked out in 74 and moves to Denmark. And these two kids grow up in Denmark. One is restless and always seeking meaning of life. And he finds it finally by going back to Russia and working for the Patriarch. The Russian Orthodox Church would have a big department in Moscow. His mother is very devout Orthodox Christian. And the other guy who tells a story is more superficial and lives his life, and of course you can't write a novel about that. So on page one, his brother is killed. So he has to go with his mother back to Russia to see what happened to my brother and what happened to our son, or her son. And was it just a mucking? There's a lot of violent mucking in Moscow, but what's behind this? And I wanted to write a story about the very close nowadays relationship between Putin's Kremlin and the Russian Orthodox Church, which was basically extinct in 1924, but saved during the Second World War and was living quietly in cooperation with the KGB during the 70s and 80s. And now it's a very strong force in the Russian society because it's basically a church that, of course, is Christians and all that is very important. But the most important is to be a savior of everything Russian. Anyway, that I wanted to do. And then I wanted to make a comparison, really, between today's Russia and the Soviet Union. And this woman, she leaves Russia and swears never to go back, but she has to go back because her son is killed. And in Russia, her other surviving son finally gets the story of her and his father's love story. And it is it's a great love story. It's not just a love story, it's a wonderful love story. It's a romantic love story. And therefore, he learns a lot about himself, he learns a lot about his family, and he learns a lot about Russia going back and see what has happened. As his mother says, she hasn't been there for 37 years, and everything is new in Russia, right? There's lots of shops and cars and modernity, everything is modern. There's nothing to do with the Soviet Union. But she's skeptical, so she says, okay, the blonde might color her hair, but the blonde is still a blonde. And you get this contract between nowadays, today's Russia, and then the Soviet Union and this long, long shadow that it's still cast on today's Russia. And that was really what I wanted to do, but basically I wanted to tell a story about two brothers.
L'histoire de mon dernier livre, ça, il s'agit de deux frères, des jumeaux, avec des parents, un Danois comme père et une maman russe. Et l'un des fils est perdu, il est tué quand il retourne en Russie. La famille retourne en Russie et découvre des secrets de l'histoire d'amour entre les parents. Mais aussi, j'aime comparer l'Union soviétique d'OTAN avec la Russie actuelle.
I think we're time's up. I think,
we have to go and sign books.
Yes, and well, if I have one thing to say to you, and je vais le dire en français, les livres de ces auteurs sont extraordinaires. Donc courez les acheter, dévorez-les, comme j'ai eu le plaisir de le faire pendant cet été. Merci de votre attention. Thank you all. It was very nice. Merci.